Yeah, hi, podcast listeners. We just had 2 hours of awesome radio that didn't get recorded. Sorry about that. I started the program and started the recording, and it didn't keep recording. I'll keep trying to do better. After all, Melanoma's speaking tonight, and we all know her motto, be best, blah. I wouldn't even have looked had Randy and PA not said there was a slight streaming glitch. I thought I was listening to an old program in fallback mode. No. No, you're fully in the present. Oh, regarding honeybees, Brother Deacon Asa says, Libtalker uses platform to anthropomorphize insects at the expense of patriotic Americans. And as to the as to the pile of rocks there in near Forest Park in St. Louis, Brother Deacon Asa says, let's not pretend it's such a hot, highfalutin house, Bob. 1.7 mil will buy you a fixer-upper in Vancouver, even with the exchange rate. One Portland Place, St. Louis, Missouri, 63108. The Zestimate, the Zillow estimate, 1,719,342 bucks. Off the market. You know, I get the idea it might go on the market. Bob, stop telling us you didn't record the program. Is this program a repeat of the Lost June 10th program? Okay, beam me up. There's no sign of life down here. No, it's going to be like that that one Beatles cover. That there were only a few copies of. Nope, no copy of this one. Damn it. Exactly, Will in Chicago. The interior of the house reminds me of a line from a Robert V. Parker Spencer novel. The university president's office looked like a successful Victorian brothel. Yeah, those are good novels, too. No wonder Trump would feel at home with the McCloskeys. That's the first thing I thought when I originally saw the article from STL Mag. This looks every bit as tacky as somewhere that Donald Trump would live. I mean, hell, you could get a crane and perch Kimberly Gargoyle on a cornice, and she'd be right at home. Get it, Kimberly Gargoyle. Thank you, Darlene. I didn't realize that. Randy from PA pointing out Diogenes and Green Lantern comic characters. It's a recurring theme, as the Green Lantern characters in DC Comics are partially based on the Greek myth of Diogenes. Now he dipped. Lord, there's so much stuff out there. Sparky's been tracing or following the ongoing saga of the aftermath of the super spreader event there in Sturgis, South Dakota. From the LA Times, the hundreds of thousands of bikers who attended the Sturgis motorcycle rally may have departed western South Dakota, but public health departments in multiple states are trying to measure how much and how quickly the coronavirus spread in bars, tattoo parlors, and gatherings before people traveled home to nearly every state in the country. And you know, it only takes one, especially if they have depraved hearts and don't care where they don't care where they spread the disease. From the city of Sturgis to health departments in at least six states, health officials are trying to track outbreaks from the 10-day rally that ended August 16th. They face the task of tracking an invisible virus that spread among bar hoppers and rallygoers who then traveled to over half of the counties in the United States. Man, isn't it going to be something when the ACC and the SEC start to play in the football? You want to get a case of the turtle squirts? Anonymous cell phone data indicates that 61% of all the counties in the United States have been visited by someone who went to Sturgis. That makes Sturgis, as the LA Times article notes, a travel hub comparable to a major U.S. city. Navin Vembar, co-founder of Camber Systems, said, "Imagine trying to do contact tracing for the entire city of Washington, D.C., but you also know that you don't have any distancing, or the distancing is very, very limited. The masking is limited. It all adds up to a very dangerous situation for people all over the place. Contact tracing becomes dramatically different, difficult." Health departments in four states, including South Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, and Wyoming, have reported a total of 81 cases among people who attended the super spreader. North Dakota and Washington have also reported infections to South Dakota health officials, who I dare say probably, they are at the very least handcuffed and hamstrung, because you got a governor out there, Kristi Noem, who is so thoroughly, she's Kristi Noem, human suppository, going right up the old fundament of Donald J. Trump. And so anybody who calls themselves a public health official in South Dakota is practicing their craft with one foot in a bucket. Because to this day, Kristi Noem opposes any requirement that people wear masks. Stephen Sample went to the rally. He rode back home to Arizona last week because, you know, Arizona doesn't have any coronavirus. "I sat at a bar elbow to elbow with guys. No one was wearing masks." And he went to one hotspot bar, the One-Eyed Jack Saloon. "But I ain't had no COVID-19 symptoms. I was thinking about quarantining with the wife, but I decided not to. It's probably a hoax anyway." I added that part. God almighty.
"Are you saying you don't want to quarantine with me, Bob?"
Oh, honey, I would quarantine with you anywhere, anytime. You doll.
You're so sweet. I love you.
I love it when Agnes comes back.
Hi, everybody.
Everybody says hey.
Send him my love.
Hey to Goober.
Send him my love.
No, I think you just did. So, we'll just keep watching that story as that continues to blow up. Oh, well, thank you, Billable Rick. Billable Rick has awarded me a cowbell. That's for you could perch Kimberly Gargoyle on a cornice and she'd be right at home. Yeah. Hey, let's run over to the stress line and see what's going on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Bob. It's Mark, the wandering ex-Marine.
What do you know, Mark?
I'm headed your direction, but I'm still way south of you. But actually, I'm considering going to the march this weekend in D.C. I'm not fully committed yet, and I really don't want to RSVP and and not show up. Like I would make a difference, but the point is that there'll be I imagine quite a few people there Friday and Saturday. I wanted to ask you. It sounds like you're feeling better. Am I right in that, Bob?
Yeah, I am. There's nothing like a few days of ibuprofen and water for settling whatever it is that was ailing me.
I've listened to you so long now that I can hear in your voice your fatigue. I can hear a lot in your voice now over time just listening to you. So I wanted to express my hearing. The other night when you didn't feel well, I felt bad for you, and so it's like I have a hard time saying listen, but you did a great job of handling your show, and so that's a sign of a true pro. So,
well, thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, and you're really therapy for yourself, and you're really therapy for all that listen to you, because your values are based, you're value based. So, any case, and you help us all get back to ground. So, but I wanted to make a comment because all of these shootings. It's hard for me. Like I didn't watch the shooting that took place in Wisconsin until I think today. When footage comes out, I can't immediately watch different things because I'm just kind of full of it. Not that I'm Rambo. It's just I've kind of had enough. I try to drive around the stress, but it gets to a point where I let me see what everybody's talking about, and And then I saw a special. It was pretty well done. It was, I don't think it was 48 hours. It might have been 60 minutes. But they're showing that law enforcement training, like everything else in our society now, it's less humans involved, less instructors, and more videos. And this video training, which I did not experience, and I'm familiar with it. I've been around the machine. I think it's like hitting those golf ball things. And you take a swing at, I think I've actually messed around with it, but not in an official rating capacity, but it didn't really interest me. And a lot of guys that are all into the Rambo stuff, they like those paintball guns. And they used to say, even in the time when I was in the Corps, could we train with them? And I was so glad that for the most part, there are some Marine units that did, they avoided that. And I think, that was good that they did avoid that type of stuff, because you're really dealing with such life and death situations that paintball guns kind of give you a false bravado of your physicality and your victim's circumstance. So I'm glad I didn't mess with that. And I was good at all that stuff. I mean, I'm not, I guess it is bragging, but I had a natural proclivity. I'm an old baseball player, a tennis player, and could throw a punch, and I was a pretty decent pitcher, so I kind of had a lot of good hand-eye coordination, not even bad basketball player, so shooting and things came natural for me, and I kind of had a groovy father who had been a Marine, and he said, Mark, if you want to own a gun, you're going to have to buy it yourself. He said, I've seen what guns can do to people, and I don't really care to have one in my house. He said, but if you think you want one, and you earn the money for it, when you're ready, let me know, and I'll tell you whether you can have it or not, but I'm not going to tell you no. And that's exactly what I did. And that gun was sought after by some guys.
Mark, I understand people's fascination with firearms, because anything of human ingenuity can be the source of fascination. Now, I'm much more likely to be fascinated with various and sundry smoker designs, but you can get real nerdy about them too. I stay in a constant state of conflict with Brother Deacon Asa, because he thinks I, by God, need a pellet grill. And I, by God, don't want a pellet grill. Because if you can set it and forget it, Well, just go down to the barbecue joint and get you some.
Yeah, just get it to go anyway. I want to.
I want to work on it. I want to fuss over it. I want to be meticulous about how my fire starts and grows and builds and maintains, and I want to be able to smoke a pork shoulder or a brisket or a chicken and be able to look at it and touch it and know when it's done. Because that,
and you already have an idea.
That's mastery. And you can, the gun people are like that too. And a whole bunch of them, I got no beef with them. But the ones I do have a beef with are the ones that are such a bunch of pathetic chicken shits that they can't go down to the Rippy Mart for a bag of ice without packing sufficient heat to take out a fucking platoon.
Yeah, and we're seeing that, by design, and I understand what you're saying about the smoker, and I think even as you get attached to one, or you, I think you've actually moved on to another one where you may not have cared for your first one. It's like you said, it's about anything that the humans come up with. If you fall, develop an interest in it, it can continue to grow. And in your case, you've got air and induction and heat and location where you actually place the grill. There's a lot of contributing factors that if you get good at anything, there's a lot of contributing factors, and you can tell somebody that not mess with it immediately. I'm not guessing, I know that you could pick something up at the store or ask for something to be cut, and once you get it in your hands, you already know what your mind's already determined how long it's going to be before you even have to open it up to check it, because of the weight and the type of meat that you've ordered or whatever. A lot of us enjoy listening to you, including myself, listening to you, describe, your cooking, all of your affection for that. And I agree with the gun thing, and I'm not saying you said that I was, but the gun thing, I think one of the things I would express to anybody listening, when it comes to what we're witnessing and what's always been out there, it's just being filmed now, which is what they say. And I agree with that. But that, I think one thing that the academies don't teach, and most academies, that's the longest, are 6 months. One thing they don't teach, Bob, and not get it by the time you get out of the academy. But it's communication, and it's body language, and it's attitude. And I think you can set people off so easily that you can take somebody that's pretty much law-abiding their whole lives and really trigger them into doing something that's unlike them normally.
You've got some expertise in this realm, Mark, and I'd appreciate it. Uh-huh. And I realize I'm probably going to be calling on you for speculation, and that's not my intent, but I don't think it's going to be avoidable. What, I mean, can you come up with any justification for law enforcement officers to shoot an unarmed man in the back 7 times?
Okay, so I asked myself that. I actually asked myself that before I watched the video. I'm like, what is that all about? And I actually wrote a friend of mine. He is a gun. He's the grandson of a Florida Highway Patrolman who was a pretty reasonable man, it sounds like. He died before I had a chance to meet him. But he did a great job of being a mentor towards my friend. And my friend is a very knowledgeable person about high-speed motorcycles and guns. He knows a shitload more. I'm an operator. I'm not a mechanic. I can drive it, but I couldn't fix it. But so I guess what I had to watch a couple times was to begin with, a gun aimed at someone, whether you've had communication with them or you're just starting it. A gun doesn't, and that wasn't your question, but I'm answering where I'm trying to end up.
That's okay.
In my mind. But when a gun gets aimed at somebody, you've kind of lost control. And then when they take control, you're out of options. And so as he follows the one and two policemen, and actually, if I counted it right, I've seen five in the video, and I think that means there may have been six altogether. But I'll go conservative. But I counted five people in the video in uniform, in short order. And in the original altercation, it looks like three or four. And they follow the gentleman around the car. And he's picking up speed as he's walking. And the dude's, I can't tell
he's got
I
can imagine because he's got babies in the car. And he's scared.
Well, right.
Not, and
he
he's
wants
scared
to get
not
back
for,
and,
he's not just scared for his life. He's scared for theirs at this point.
Well, right. Like a mother hen and or a father hen, and he's a father rooster, but he has a right to get back to what he's concerned about. And he's been placed in fear. And from what I've read, Bob, that he was actually a peacemaker, not really involved with the original call. That he just
right. There was nothing. He had done nothing with which to be charged. There was no apparent violation of any aspect of any criminal code.
So out of the blue, this gentleman's now suddenly the focus of the whole circumstance. And he's walking, and as you watch, at the very end, the one cop almost bumps, or maybe does bump, his partner out of the way, and he grabs him by the flimsiest of tank tops. So that cop, to begin with, shouldn't have had his weapon out. As the gentleman's fleeing, your gun aimed at them is really slowing you down from getting to an appropriate response. So if he's reaching, if in their mind, that person was reaching for something, if you have a gun in your
hand. So is that, wait, that just dawned on, is that going to be the justification? We thought he had a gun in the car.
Get away with it?
We thought he had a gun in the car.
No, I'm not saying that. No, what I'm saying is the way they explained it at the academy is when a human being is standing in front of you, a subject, a suspect, an individual that you've come in contact with, as that human being is facing you in uniform, that human being has a plane of glass through it, right through the shoulders, through the head, through the chest, and until that plane of glass is broken and coming towards you with a deadly weapon as a gun coming towards you, at that point, you have the authority to use deadly force at that point. But until that occurs, you do not. So not only has he not broken the plane of glass, if he was reaching for a weapon, it's away from the cop. So he was never in, like you've heard people say, and I would agree with that interpretation, the policemen, and I think you said it, the policemen were not in fear of being harmed at that time. They would have to wait for him to be successful at that. So my experience, having done the job, tells me what you do is you reholster your weapon as he's expediting to his vehicle. And if you can't stop him with a taser, which those were before my time, you grab him and you grab both wrists. And if the other useless cop can't help, well, that's life in the slow lane. But the point is, you have to have those skills, because otherwise you end up with death. And we have to have, if you don't have the ability to snatch somebody up, and you can't grab somebody by a stupid tank top, that's about as grabbing somebody by a Kleenex. So you have to grab them by the wrist, and then ensues a struggle. But that's why it's incumbent upon you to have physical skills to do the job. Unfortunately, it can be a rough line of work. I'm not criticizing people in uniform arbitrarily, but my experience was, and I've had situations where I've dealt with people, and by my communication skill in a nighttime stop in on the edge of Little Havana in Miami at 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, when we pulled somebody over, we knew they were up to no good in a Volvo a used Volvo, and they were rolling through the area. So we knew something wasn't right. And so my partner pulls him over, or I pulled him over, or whatever the case was. And my communication skill allowed me, as I'm looking at him, he didn't realize I had my gun aimed at him. As I reached between his legs through either an open door at that point, I don't think I exposed my whole chest to him, so I don't think I reached in, but I reached in between his legs and pulled out a .45 and just calmly tucked it in behind my back in my belt. And we were going to let him go for whatever the reason was, because he had a decent attitude. He was a bad guy, and he was rolling with protection. But I guess the point is, you have to have physical skills, not just shooting skills, and you also have to have communication skills to prevent having to use the physical skill, unless you're dealing with someone who has temporary or permanent mental instability, and then they're not going to recognize.
In which case, the police are exactly the wrong people to be there. You need mental health professionals.
Right.
And by the way, Dave number 11 just told me, Mark, part of the cop narrative is that Blake said he was going into the car to get a gun and he was brandishing a knife.
Well, you know,
that smells like bullshit to me.
Yeah, well, where's the gun and where's the knife? Because I've looked at the video a few times. I don't see a knife. Now, if he's got a knife, a pocket knife, you just can't shoot somebody because they're in possession of a knife. Now, if it's in their hand and they're coming at you, that's different. Or he's turned and he's got it, and it's a standoff. At that point, it becomes debatable with you, depending on.
I don't care if, to quote W.C. Fields, he has an assegai. He's not much danger with his back turned to him.
Totally agree. If you think about it, now I didn't see a knife in his hand, and people are saying that in different comments on different things, and I scroll past them. I'm not going to argue with every hillbilly that justifies every murder that takes place. not the good hillbillies, the bad hillbillies.
Not all hillbillies. You know, yes, I know.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm playing.
I know. That's the Jimmy Carter hillbillies I love. I would die for and almost did, and would gladly serve President Carter any day. But so I don't know. That's the narrative, and they once they get that down, that becomes the statement. It's just like the lawyer for Chauvin's. Partner, the Oriental looking policeman in Milwaukee or Minneapolis, or he was commenting on the Chauvin person himself. But I listened to him, a lawyer, his defense lawyer, and he floated it on the news that he said that they had been trained, and then he showed a little photograph. Some kind of they scoured training manuals from here to who knows where, and got a photograph of how to detain a subject that's on the ground with your knee. In that similar position, which is not what occurred. But that was one of his comments, and that got shown on the news. And then he said they were just holding him until the medical people got there. And I thought, now, you know, that would fool a lot of people. But unfortunately, the medical people had to fight to get the cops off of him, and they were there for, I think, 3 minutes and a minute and a half where they struggle with the cops to get the hell off him and get away from it. And the one nurse that was there, an off-duty nurse, argued with them right on the spot. So that's a bullshit line. And, of course, the defense will be able to hopefully take care of that, most coach. But any case, it's just it's a rough line of work. They lost control of the situation. And aiming a gun at somebody that's upset doesn't mean crap, and especially to people who have grown up in rough areas. Aiming a gun at people is really shows a cop a rookie side. I don't know, man. I have my gun out, and I aimed it at people sometimes without them knowing it. Or I had it down by my leg as I walked up to your car, but I'm turned at an angle with my diplomatic left hand asking for a driver's license. But my weapon was in my hand and you may never have seen it. I had a Secret Service, Caucasian Secret Service agent, flag us down in Little Havana at 3 o'clock in the morning, one morning, and my Puerto Rican American Army partner, who was probably one of the most aggressive cops in the whole city of Miami Police Department, the two of us made good partners because tactically we kept up with each other. He had more experience on the street. I did surprise him a few times, but Carlos, I said, Carlos, did you see that dude back there? He goes, what dude? And I go, that white guy standing in the corner right there. He goes, oh, bullshit. I go, I'm telling you, bro, go back. Well, we went back and we rolled up on the guy. Well, I wore a baseball cap sometimes or no hat at all, but I had it on because it was cool out. And I took the stupid hat off and put my pistol in it because I didn't know who this guy was. He walked up to the car quite bravely. And so my gun is aimed at him. He doesn't realize that he's talking to Carlos, who's driving the squad car. So, but I was diplomatic and casual. But the gun, I'm just sharing with the audience, guns don't really influence the situation. And case in point would be what we witnessed there in Kenosha. That gun isn't going to influence him and did so. It does look like another case of negligence at minimum. So I don't know what the charges are.
We don't even know if they're going to be charged.
Right.
But in Wisconsin, it's an entirely different story than in Minnesota, where, you know, at least you've got Keith Ellison in the attorney general's office. Let me ask you a second question, if I may. And this is about, because I'm thinking about seven rounds.
I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at that.
No, I'm wondering, are these, and I'm sure it varies from department to department, do police officers get to choose what kind of rounds they'll carry, or is that departmentally mandated?
No, they do not, and it is usually departmentally mandated. It's a and you described it earlier. It's an acceptable round that the city and the lawyers and the administration agrees to, and that's what you will be found carrying. And there are cases where the police will carve up bullets, or they will carry their own ammunition, carry throw down weapons. I know that to be a fact. I did not do that. I did carry a backup knife, a nice straight blade Gerber in my combat boot. And I also carried the same Gerber knife in my vest sometimes.
I'm asking because
shock plate. Yeah.
Most departments, I think it's safe to say, no longer do back in the day, the West Virginia State Police carried, and most departments carried, a 357, Smith & Wesson 357 mag, walnut handle classic.
Correct.
But then they moved over to, I think, a 40 Smith, which, of course, is roughly a 10 millimeter bullet. A little bit more kinetic energy in the bullet because it's slightly bigger than the 9 millimeter, which is basically the same as a 38 caliber bullet. And I know this sounds like we're kind of off in the weeds, but I'm off in the weeds for a reason.
No.
In the weeds for a reason, Mark.
Yeah.
Because some bullets do more damage than other bullets. And in fact, ammunition manufacturers go to great lengths to explain how much more damaging their rounds are. I did some research a little while back and I was looking at 9 millimeter bullets because I was trying to figure out, again, seven rounds. That seems even if it was some sort of horrifying situation, it seems excessive unless there was, shots about to be fired or something, which is clearly not the case here. But you can take a 9 millimeter round, full metal jacket. And I think most people probably know what that means. It's a lead core with a complete jacket of copper around it and literally a typical rounded bullet nose. And those things will exit a 9mm pistol well in excess of 1,200 feet per second. And because they're jacketed, they tend to go through people. Well, there are manufacturers who make ammunition expressly for law enforcement, and their sales pitch is that this thing is not going to just go through somebody. It's going to go into them, and it is going to tear the living bejesus out of everything it touches. Bone, organs, blood vessels, muscle, what have you. And has a debilitating, and they brag about the debilitating effect.
Sure.
I mentioned, like 115 grain, 9mm bullet. There's a company called Hornady. And they manufacture something for law enforcement called a critical duty. And that little bastard is a 145 grain jacketed hollow point with a notched nose, and they actually fill in the hollow point with a flat ballistic tip. So that thing's going to, the size of the bullet reduces the muzzle velocity below 1,000 feet per second to the point where it's actually manifesting a speed more in line with a 45 caliber bullet. And because it's 30 grains heavier than the ordinary full metal jacket 115 grain, it tears, and because that hollow point is filled in with that ballistic plastic, it's ruinous to be struck by one. And so I'm wondering if at some point in the overall discussion of policing, the issue of ammunition itself should come into the discussion. I mean, hell, seven rounds of 115 grain 9mm full metal jacket is not going to be a walk in the park. But in those,
right, and one thing you're not,
I was going to say, but those things can be hole punches, and they're going so fast they just all the way through, and they are they're actually more almost obscene to talk in these terms, but they create a more survivable wound. But because
a more what type of
a more survivable wound. Yeah. But they virtue of the fact that they can pass right through a human body, that puts anybody behind the bullet behind the victim at risk of being shot as an innocent bystander.
Correct. Yeah, the liability of a fast moving round also, right?
But if you hit a human being with seven rounds of one of these ultra modern, ultra high tech, super penetrating, they literally mushroom, and they have teeth when they mushroom,
sure,
and they go through like a meat grinder at 800 feet per second. And I'm
wondering who saved him.
I just wonder if that is a manifestation of not just an unnecessary use of deadly force, but a willfully unnecessary use of deadly force.
Well, I think you could take a look at that, and I think one way to determine that is how if in fact those were the types of rounds used, and also how widespread it is in the industry or the business, so to speak. The air marshals, I guess, have a round that's designed for being shot within an airplane, so it hits you and doesn't come out and sink the airplane. So, there is that that option, I suppose. But then the argument is, it's in the militarization of law enforcement over the last 40 or 50 years. It goes back to the 60s with SWAT, Los Angeles, and everything else. It's militarize the police and policification of the armed forces. And yes, and what we're just going to say one thing, Bob, and because that it kind of confused me at first. Did the one policeman shoot seven times? But no, I think what it was simultaneous fire, which is what you'll see from going to shooting all the time with your fellow cop. You get simultaneous shooting, and I think they do that to kind of cover each other. Let's just shoot this guy so much that nobody will have a story to tell the truth.
Oh, Jesus Christ, and it's Julius right. Caesar all over again. Because,
right. Let's all stab him. Right?
Right. Everybody has to stab him because that way nobody can be individually liable.
Correct. And they do that. They do that. And I know that. And then the Marines have language for that. And it doesn't always apply, but weapons discipline, you know, so.
Yeah.
But that doesn't always apply. But, you know, well-trained people can make a difference. But it can also make you vulnerable.
Did you happen to run across the story? Because, you know, in America, anything is possible, especially if it's monumentally fucking stupid. There is a trend, Mark, and this is probably going to make you just run out into the night, eating dirt and running rabbits and barking like a squirrel.
Yeah.
There is a thing in America now where because people who know how to handle firearms have been so, they're actually vigilant. I know this sounds crazy to some, but it won't to you, I don't think. You know, Marine, law enforcement, firearm discipline.
Yeah. Right.
In the circles where people talk about firearms, nothing will get you ganged up on faster than, excuse me, than posting a photograph of yourself holding a firearm with your finger on the fucking trigger. You know,
correct.
Like Patty
correct.
McCloskey yes. did there in St.
Correct.
Louis. You know, that famous photo
with
of her.
Mustard on her shirt. She, correct.
It, yeah. Right. Yeah. She's got her finger through the trigger guard on the trigger.
Just looking at that picture makes me nervous. I can see it shaking. I have to look at that picture about three times to make sure. Is that damn thing moving? Is that thing shaking at me? I'm like, what the hell?
Exactly. So,
what a fucking idiot.
So in these various internet fora, the response, and I know I use the term satirically sometimes, but the responsible gun owners will just they will just rain seven shades of vicious hell on these assholes who present photos of themselves holding firearms with abysmal firearm discipline.
Correct. Yeah, it is.
And so now, Mark, and this is the part where you run out and run rabbits. Now a thing has developed where people proudly post photos of themselves holding firearms with bad weapon discipline. You know, with their finger through the, you know, through the trigger guard, on the trigger, etc. And it's a fad now to post those things. Sort of as a, nah, you can't make me, fuck you. So, not long back.
It's being done intentionally, okay.
Yeah, okay. It's all intentional. It is the firearm equivalent of refusing to wear a goddamn mask. That's exactly what
right.
it is. So not long back,
right?
One guy, you can't make me have good weapons discipline. I got Second Amendment rights. It's right there in the Constitution. Was all proud because he was going to post a photo of himself with his freedom protector, with his finger on the trigger. And just as he went, and he was going to show what a real badass he was, by pointing it at his crotch.
Excellent.
So he goes to take the photograph, and I guess there's a little left-right sort of conflict going on, and apparently he's getting ready to click the button on the phone to take the picture of himself pointing his fucking gun at his fucking dick, and he goes to take the picture, and all of a sudden the gun goes, bang, and he shoots his dick off.
Oh, oh good. Good shot. Damn.
Apparently... Well, apparently, yeah. You know, took out Big Jim and one of the twins.
Well, it's a seeing eye dog that's no longer with us. But, wow, I...
Wait, hold the fuck I'm on.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. It's terrible. It's horrifying. Yeah. But yeah. Jesus Christ, yeah, when you're trying to do it and you succeed to own the responsible gun owner libtards... Holy shit!
You've got all the time in the world to do it. Really, you would think. I mean, what's the rush? Let's get this right. And I'll just show you. And that's sad. That's and but you know, it's kind of it makes me happy. I ran into people in the short time I did the job, Bob, that were so they were like groupies. They scared me. In a different kind of way, but they feared me. I mean, they didn't fear me, but I'm just saying they bothered me. I'm like, get the fuck out of here with that stupid radio and your fucking guns. And, I'm like, I couldn't even see out of a gas station, set of windows, Bob, in Miami by the old Orange Bowl. There had been a shootout that lasted quite a while. There was so much blood on the inside of the windows of that gas station. I had to wipe a little bit of the blood off. A lot of the blood that was on the phone just to pick it up because I wanted to call my girlfriend, who's now my wife now, some 40 years later, 30 some years later here. But, and just to hear her voice, she's, where are you calling me from? Like, well, I'm in Miami, Chris, I'm downtown. But I guess the thing, there's so much bizarre shit out there that it's, I was in the station one night and I see this, a B shift guy. I work C shift from 9 at night till 7 in the morning. There was the B shifters. They come in and then they get off like at we overlap. So I think they get off at 2 or 3 in the morning. So they're on the streets at peak hours. I didn't know the guy. And I go, what you got there? And he goes, you want to see? Take a look. And it was a violin case. And he was turning it in the property and opened it up. And it was a chrome Thompson submachine gun with a drum in. I mean,
holy crap.
You could comb your hair. And I go, what's the deal with that? And he goes, bro, we were chasing this guy in Liberty City. And he dropped it. And he goes, we picked it up. We didn't catch him, but we got the gun. And I go, he goes, check it out. They have so many guns. And they're not the only department that does it, but they take them out once a year and they drop them in the ocean in big cages. I don't know what the size of the, you know, like 8x8 cages.
Man, I bet the salt water's hell. I bet the salt water's hell on that chrome.
Oh my God. Yeah, sure it is. Sure, and actually, I was about to parkerize finish, and I wipe my weapon down constantly because of the humidity there.
But, yeah, and the salt air.
And I was in the salt air. I mean, you could it just didn't take any time at all. We would ride with the air conditioning on high with our windows down, so you could hear which direction shit was coming from. I mean, people, when you, I know, I used to, for 20 years in the union, I really never mentioned that I wore the uniform, but I did over time towards the end of my time as a carpenter, people would ask and I'm like, yeah, I did, I've worked. And, but people, the law abiding citizens have no idea how wide open it's been and continues to be. I'm sure I'm not defending,
yeah, but Jesus Christ, not to minimize anything. But it ain't like Kenosha, Wisconsin is Coral Gables.
Well, right. Yeah,
is it?
Or, yeah. No. It's, Coral Gables would be the nice area, but I know what you meant. I think you meant like Little Havana or Overtown or a rougher area, Liberty City.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Okay, sure. I wouldn't know. I've been through. Couple of times, but that's about it.
Yeah. Well, Coral Gables is also, it butts right up the University of Miami, and some of the most horrendous crimes have taken place there. But they're not. It's not. It's just. It's a very rare place to see the horrendous crime. But we had a cop shot there, and a robbery of a jewelry store, and they shot him in the neck, and he was a canine officer, and his dog, it was in the back seat, flipped out, and I think they had to tranquilize the dog just to be able to get him out of the car because it had lost its mind, and I think the policeman died, but the bad guy got away, and that was like at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. It was so many war stories. I mean,
you'll find this interesting, yeah. Mark. I just got a note from Unbillable Rick. He says I was in Vietnam after My Lai. We had rules of engagement. We couldn't just fire at anybody we wanted to. And if we violated the rules, we could be prosecuted under the UCMJ. And that was for a time of war. We had to determine if the people were a threat. The police should have the same rules.
Yeah, let's start there. I mean, and it's under similar circumstances.
There's a larger issue there. And I've talked about it in the past. Maybe we need something similar to the UCMJ for law enforcement. You don't get to take advantage of the laws that apply to civilians who don't necessarily have the training or the experience that you do. Maybe you're judged.
I think that's a great observation.
Maybe you're judged by a higher standard.
I think that's a great observation. Now, to a degree, the laws aren't applicable. But and that's not what you're saying. But whenever there's a questionable case, the state will investigate, and that's no news to yourself. But in Florida, it's the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or in South Carolina, you know, it varies per se. Obviously, that's not what you're saying. But I agree, there should be national standards with a national review and a national set of.
I've come to the conclusion, Mark, that nobody who, you know, your local county prosecutor should never be allowed to prosecute a cop or take a cop to a grand jury.
Conflict of interest.
Because
it is an
explicit conflict of interest. We need individual state level. You know how we've got the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and that's all they do?
I understand that, yeah.
We need judges who all they do is hear cases involving police or law enforcement. And we need a prosecutor.
That makes sense.
We need prosecutors who have absolutely nothing to do with law enforcement. They need to be absolutely neutral and insulated and untouchable. They need not to be subject to pressure tactics or anything from like police unions or any of that. And that's the only way that I think we can ever approach justice. I mean, the fact that the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Kentucky is an out and out proud maggot, and this is the guy in charge of determining whether to charge three cops who murdered Breonna Taylor in her bed? Oh, fuck, no. Come on, man.
Well, that's the results of that. That's what we're looking at. That's why that is what it is. I agree. That's a neat take, Bob, and it only makes sense. I mean, when I left, they asked for an evaluation. They asked you why you're leaving the department. I just said, poor leadership. I got into a situation with a racist cop in Liberty City.
Yeah, we talked about that.
He got in over his head. And then when the sergeant showed up, he was a bigger redneck than my partner. And I went, I'm fucked. But I won my case. But, you know, I guess the point is, I couldn't call him out by name and I couldn't bring charges against him. But it was like there was no body for you to appeal to. Whereas in the armed services, within the armed forces, there is Of course, you would have to be caught in the system somehow, but there's an appeal system to where you can kind of get your case heard, adjudicated one way or the other, so you can move forward or sideways or backwards. But it doesn't really exist, and it is cousins and cocksuckers, and then that's what leads to the constant corruption and any case that's why it doesn't seem to improve. I like the idea, and it should be national. There isn't any national standards. It should be national hearings, and there should be civilian review boards as well. I'm a big fan of that, and I think they do try to have that in place in some places. But any case, you may have another caller, Bob. I just wanted to call and let you know that communication is what sets people off, and I don't think that's part of what's happening. And I think when people get pulled over, they're not intimidated anymore, and they shouldn't be. But the cops are all myths because they're so iconoclastic. Is that the right word? Where they're just all into themselves in their own tunnel, that they think everybody's either out to get them, or they're supposed to be feared, or that they are somebody. And they are somebody. They're a public servant, but that's the extent of it.
Yeah, and you know who they've got. You know who they have to thank for all that fear, Mark? The National Ruble Association, because it's the NRA that has for years encouraged, everybody got to have a gun. Only way to have a civil society is if everybody's got 72 freedom protectors.
And like Israel.
And the thing is, that means that thanks to that, in states like Florida and West Virginia, you know, places where the NRA holds great sway, that means there is no longer is there any such thing as a routine traffic stop. Every stop is a potential gunfight because of the paranoid, bloodthirsty rhetoric that has flowed like a goddamned open sewer from the NRA.
That's correct.
Since Nixon ran for re-election. Because that's literally about the same time that it starts. Yeah.
Sure. And when I first got to Miami, Bob, they still had armor-piercing rounds that you could buy legally from gun shops. You'd go in and get them. They were American. You could Czechoslovakian, and they made another one like in Colombia. And so I wore a baked ceramic plate on my chest because it would stop one round, but two rounds, you would be dead with one round from the trauma. But they made those illegal on a city scale shortly after
And I'm sure somebody, I'm sure the NRA lobbyist in Tallahassee had a blue, purple, polka-dotted scream and hissy fit when they did. Oh, they're stealing our freedom!
They're stealing my freedoms, my constitutionals. Hey, Bob, I got to let you go. I appreciate you asking me the good questions, and it sounds like you've given things some thought that only make a whole lot of sense.
No, I sit around thinking. I sit around thinking about this stuff all the time. Well, Mark, let me let you know this conversation has meant a lot to folks. I had a lovely note from Jude in the Great Northwest. She said that she said your perspective on the use of armed violence it really touched her, and moments of being caught in the height of emotional stress and yet unable to shift into your own personal ability to be disciplined. She says, good discussion, you two. So, you know, Mark, you touch people. You touch people.
Well, and Jude, stay safe out there, and we're keeping an eye on the area, and watch out for the Blue Lives Matter people. The current director of Proud Boys for the United States is a Cuban-American named Enrique Chario. And he's been floated out there. He hasn't been out there recently, to my knowledge, but he has been featured. He's the national person. He comes out of the state of Florida, and it's orchestrated by right out of the White House. A lot of this, so
no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you go, and thank you, Mark, for calling in. I really appreciate the conversation. You take care, my friend. Stay safe.
All right, Bob. Have a good dinner.
I'm right after the show. Later. Our buddy Mark, calling from parts unknown. Sometimes I know where Mark is. Sometimes I don't. But I really appreciated the conversation because one of the things that Jude mentioned earlier that she's trying to sort of pull together into a cohesive narrative is the crap that happened over the weekend in Portland, wherein the cops stood idly by while the fascist bully boys, you know, the Boogaloo boys and the Proud Boys, those assholes, went about the business of beating the hell out of anybody that they decided needed the hell beat out of them. And the cops just sat there and, lovely day, whatever. And only acted if they were acting against one of the enemies of these fucking brown shirts. Yeah. So it's pretty much time to get out of here. I'm sorry I screwed up the podcast. Oh, Jesus. But at least we got an hour's worth. If you're wondering where the other 2 hours were, I think I explained it at the beginning or what will be the beginning of the podcast. One last thing, since we're all probably getting ready to go and watch as much of the shit show as our guts will allow us to tolerate. You know, we don't have to accuse the maggots of being who they are. In true Maya Angelou form, they'll just tell us. So, tonight, a woman named Marianne Mendoza is on the speaking schedule. She is what is referred to as an angel mom. That means one of her children died. And in her case, her status as an angel mom was established because a drunk driver killed her son in 2014. But wait, there's more. The drunk driver who killed her son was in the country illegally. Okay. Well, just as we talked earlier about Mark and Patty McCloskey destroying the beehives there on the other side of the wall at the synagogue, imagine the effort that that took. You had to go all the way out, all the way around the wall, and then smash the hell out of a beehive. Nice people. Well, Marianne Mendoza, it turns out, is a QAnoner. And an anti-Semite. Good for her. No. It's just, it's who they are. It's who they are. So this evening, she'll wave the bloody shirt. But today, she tweeted a thread from a QAnon account. But not just any QAnon account. This thread was all about the Rothschilds and how they're gonna make the Goyim destroy each other. And the Jews are going to rob the Goyim of their landed properties. That's a quote from the thread. Malevolent Jewish forces in the banking industry are out to enslave non-Jews and promote world wars. Riddled with QAnon references, the thread from Twitter user at War News, WARNUSE, said, "The Jews sank the Titanic to protect the Federal Reserve. And every president since JFK has been a slave president to the global Jewish cabal." And of course, it wouldn't be a truly hateful anti-Semitic QAnon screed if it didn't include a reference to the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. Funny how things we talk about on this program wind up being reality. We were talking about the protocols of the learned elders of Zion just the other night. It was originally created by the secret police of the Tsar and eagerly picked up by the Third Reich. And here we are in 2020 and the damn thing still won't go away. And by the way, in the same thread, the story's over at Daily Beast if you want to look it up, Marianne Mendoza. Hillary Clinton's a satanic high priestess. Barack Obama's connected to the devil. And so there today, Angel Mom Marianne Mendoza tweeted, "Do yourself a favor and read this thread." And of course, the usual cannibal, pedophile, cult, sex trafficking. And Donald Trump will bring them all down. No word from the MAGOT campaign on their plan to advance an unabashedly anti-Semitic voice. Jesus, it just gets more and more sickening. Since there's only 1 hour of podcast, one more thing. From the Department of, I don't know how you're going to keep dinner down when you hear this. When he finally got back around to saying, yeah, okay, I did resign. Cucky Jerry did so, saying that it was just time for him to be away from FU, Falwell University. And in regard to stepping down as president and chancellor of the U, I couldn't make this up in a million years. I wouldn't even dream of it. He quoted and said he was quoting. He said, "As I deal with all this, I can't help but think, I can't help but recall the words of Martin Luther King. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." Yes, Jerry Falwell Jr. thinks that getting caught watching his wife have sex with a young pool boy is exactly the same as African-American people being denied constitutional civil rights and murdered at will by white mobs over the course of centuries. Exactly the same thing. Oh, and him quitting FU? Yeah, it was a hard thing. But $10.5 million will take the sting out of everybody on earth knowing that you're a weird little cucky boy who likes to watch your wife have sexy time with other men. Because that's probably what Liberty University is going to have to pay Cucky Jerry for the privilege of being shed of him. Once upon a time, there were contracts that had these things called morals clauses in them, but I guess one of the biggest evangelical Christian universities in America ain't never heard of such a thing as a morals clause. Yeah. Yeah, all right, so we finished the evening at 2:35 to go. Sorry about the podcast again, some more. Thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air. Thank you to our subscribers, Patreon and PayPal. Thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you so very much. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. It's good that I am wrapping things up because it's thundering outside and the rickety coal fried, held together by spit toilet paper and baling wire Appalachian power grid. It may go down at any minute. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Hey, thank you to Les for the cowbell for seeing eye dog. I awarded one right away. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. You know, just last month was the 15th anniversary of Gina's passing. So, by all means, please stay safe. Stay home if you can. If you have to be out and about, wear your mask, wear your gloves, wash your hands, don't touch your face. Maintain your social distance. And if it so happens that you see somebody coming at you burbling about Jewish beehives, avoid that maggot like the plague. Because they are. Later, y'all.